Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Central Florida Community Arts Symphony Orchestra, presenting Celebrate the Season, December 4th and 5th at Northland in Longwood. The country's largest orchestra shares traditional melodies, orchestral showstoppers, and more. Ticket information at cfcarts.com/NPR.
State Republicans have their eyes on a Central Florida congressional seat as mid-decade redistricting talks heat up in Florida. FDOT prepares to break ground on a $2.5 billion improvement project on I-4, and Ocala Man puts the flavors of Havana in a bottle, and Orlando hosts the inaugural HBCU Hoops Invitational. It's Thursday, December 4th, 2025, and you're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Also today, Windermere residents are shocked to learn one of their neighbors held a brutal position within Iran's infamous secret police under the reign of the Shah. We'll learn about Parvez Sabedi from the Guardian reporter who broke the story. But first, recent advances by Democrats in local and congressional special elections around the country have Republicans concerned about maintaining their congressional majorities in next year's midterm elections. President Trump has urged red states to redraw congressional districts to ensure the GOP maintains control of the House. States like Texas and Missouri responded by approving new maps in favor of Republicans. California countered by passing a voter initiative allowing that state to redraw lines, creating new Democrat seats. The redrawing of maps is now underway in red and blue states across the country, including here in Florida. Typically, congressional boundaries are redrawn every 10 years following the scheduled census. Earlier this week, Governor DeSantis, while speaking in Tampa, explained to reporters why he is seeking this redistricting.
I was hoping that we would get an extra seat because what happened was, you know, people always tell me when I criticize the census, well, Trump was president during it. Yeah, he was president up until January 20 of 2021. Then what happened? Biden came in, he issued a bunch of executive orders. They took the data and what was supposed to be two seats for Florida by April of 21, he's been in office for 100 days. They issued the apportionment and it was different than what people thought. And then they admitted a couple years later, oh yeah, Florida got undercounted, Texas got undercounted. They should have had an extra seat.
The governor also defended his support for redistricting Florida 5 years ahead of the next census count.
When did the census stop? It stopped basically March of 2020, the end of March of 2020. Well, what's happened in Florida since then? We've had a big population, so like the districts are not well apportioned. And I think that I don't think people are getting equal representation and that was a demographic shift that I don't know that we've necessarily seen in modern history before.
With the legislature just over a month away from convening the next session, voters and sitting lawmakers are waiting to see how this lands in Florida, adding in the wild card of court orders holding up similar efforts in Texas and Louisiana. Aubrey Jewett is a professor of political science at UCF. He joins Engage to parse out some of the nuances behind the state's redistricting effort. And Professor Jewett, why are national Republicans leaning so hard on Florida to pass this redistricting initiative?
In Florida, in particular, might be an important part of the Republican strategy because we're such a big state, and because potentially if the Republican legislature and Governor DeSantis engage in pretty aggressive gerrymandering, they might be able to pick up 3 to 5 Republican congressional seats. Right now it's 20 Republicans to 8 Democrats in our congressional delegation. So there's only 8 seats right now that are held by Democrats. But if there was an aggressive move to gerrymand, Republicans might pick up 3 to 5 more, and that might be enough, depending on how things go elsewhere and even in Florida in this election, that might be enough to help Republicans maintain that small lead rather than lose it to Democrats up in Washington, D.C.
We'll get into how this plays out with some of the efforts from other states as well, both for Republicans and Democrats. But here in Central Florida, there's speculation that the 9th Congressional District, currently held by Darren Soto, could be vulnerable. Also, the district over in Tampa, held by Democrat Kathy Castor. How could the face of Central Florida change politically if this is seen through?
It could be several districts in South Florida. It could be 2 or potentially all 3 districts in Central Florida that are held by Democrats. I think you're correct in pointing out that the 9th district held by Darren Soto might be one of the most vulnerable because currently it is only a Democratic seat by about 4 points or something like that. And so it wouldn't take much in terms of changing the boundaries to turn that into a more competitive seat or even maybe a slightly Republican-leaning seat. It'd be a little more difficult to get rid of Maxwell Frost's 10th congressional district, because that's got a double-digit Democratic lead. And so that would really take a wholesale redoing of the map to sort of split that one up. So he may be safe no matter what happens. Don't know for sure. So in the end, you said, how might this totally affect what Central Florida looks like, you know, in terms of congressional representation? I mean, it's possible that in an area that just a few years ago was considered sort of the ultimate swing region of the swing state, that was pretty evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, might be almost totally Republican from Tampa through Orlando over to Daytona, and maybe with just one Democratic seat here. So we don't know that's going to happen, but it's certainly a possibility. It's certainly what Republicans who want this effort to succeed would hope would happen. Of course, Florida has the Fair Districts Amendment in the Constitution, which says that you can't draw congressional districts or state legislative districts for that matter with the intent of helping or hurting a political party or incumbent.
So speaking of any challenges that this might face, we're seeing the usual suspects, the Southern Poverty Law Center, All Voting is Local, the ACLU, Equal Ground Education Fund, coalescing against this. What other challenges might this meet insofar as Democratic efforts, legal motioning, pushback from organizations like the SPLC, or even from the citizenry, the voting residents of Florida?
Well, you could see two potential avenues for legal challenge. One would be at the state level, and the other would be in federal court. So you may see some lawsuits filed in state court. And, you know, we were talking about the Fair Districts Amendment. That would certainly be most likely what would be argued in state court, that the plaintiffs would say, look, the legislature and the governor, I mean, it's very clear, President Trump has called for Republican states to create more Republican districts. And we know that the Florida Constitution forbids that. And so it's as simple as that, you know, judge or justices, depending on how far up the line it gets. And they would say, you know, clearly this is an effort to redo this. Now, the state, the legislature, the governor will probably more focus and talk about, I'm sure, while they're doing the redistricting, that they're doing it because, you know, Florida's had this population growth and because party registration has changed dramatically, and that they're just trying to draw lines neutrally to make sure that Florida voters and such are represented, you know, properly in Washington, D.C. and that sort of thing. I'm sure that's the kind of argument they will make. But in state court, anyways, that's what the plaintiffs would argue. They'd say, look, this is a clear violation of Fair Districts Amendment. We're not supposed to engage in partisan gerrymandering. At the federal level, if it goes to federal court, most likely it would come down to what the Voting Rights Act requires and doesn't require. And here we're looking at primarily race and ethnicity in drawing district lines. The Voting Rights Act, to a certain degree, protects minority voting access, as does, I might add, the Fair Districts Amendment. But it's a little unclear right now how the courts are going to rule on that. We know that the Florida Supreme Court, when they upheld the existing congressional map that took away an African-American Democratic seat up in North Florida, our Florida Supreme Court said, hey, based on our understanding of how the U.S. Supreme Court is ruling these days, that would have been an illegal racial gerrymander to draw that line. So all that to say is it's unclear exactly where the federal government is on this. There's another court case that's out of Louisiana right now, where Louisiana have one African-American district that was held by a Democrat. And then there was a lawsuit and they had to redraw the map. And now there's two African-American districts. Well, now there's another lawsuit by some white voters who are saying this second African-American district has only been drawn for racial reasons. And that's unconstitutional. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know how the federal courts would rule on any efforts here in Florida, but only that certainly plaintiffs would probably argue not only in state court, but they'd also try to make the argument in federal court that what the legislature and the governor have approved is illegal or unconstitutional for racial or ethnic discriminatory reasons.
But we've already seen the courts hold up aggressive redistricting plans in both Texas and Louisiana. Those are temporary stays currently, but they are holding those redistricting plans in limbo. Could those same arguments be applied by Democrats in Florida?
Yeah, potentially that could happen. And in the Texas case, that is what, you know, somewhat ironically, because in Florida, the Florida Supreme Court allowed the elimination of an African-American district because they said, okay, this was only drawn for racial reason, and that violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. But in Texas, when Republicans were trying to redraw districts that were more favorable to Republicans, the federal court there also ruled that they were trying to take into account race and ethnicity too much, and they were violating people's constitutional rights. So, yeah, ironically, it could happen in Florida as well, where a federal court might hold up or stop redistricting. I guess I wouldn't stop it, but they would say you couldn't use the new maps for the next election. I mean, that's a possibility. But again, we don't know for sure. I think conservatives and Republicans are relying on the fact that the Florida Supreme Court has five or six members, you know, appointed by Governor DeSantis, but there's six out of seven are pretty conservative, and they know that they ruled in the Republicans' favor in the previous redistricting battle. And they're also hoping that at the U.S. Supreme Court level, they know they have a Republican conservative majority of 6-3. And so they're hoping that ultimately when push comes to shove, maybe the Supreme Court would back them up.
We're also seeing instances where Republicans aren't fully on board for this in Indiana and Missouri. Both were frontline states in proposing new lines and redistricting this year, but they're also finding a lot of pushback from Republicans within their own state houses.
Yeah, that is interesting. You have seen that. In Indiana, there was enough so far to stop the effort. I might add, in Maryland, on the Democratic side, that's a state that might eliminate their one, you know, sole Republican congressional district. But the Senate president, who's a Democrat, and he's been president of the Senate for many years, he's dug in his heels, and he's also resisted that. So you do have in some states, some legislators or legislative leaders that don't want to go down that road and don't want to engage in midterm redistricting. I know, according to polls, most of the public doesn't agree with gerrymandering. They think it's a bad thing. However, once you start down that road and partisanship gets involved, then President Trump's asked for it, so Republicans start to get on board, and then some Democrats were saying gerrymandering's a bad thing. They're basically saying, well, we can't just give up the ship, because if the other side's going to do mid-decade redistricting and we don't, then we're just ceding control of Congress to Republicans. And so that's the argument that the governor of California made. He said, you know, I know typically I've always said, you know, we shouldn't do this gerrymandering, but if Texas is going to gain 5 Republican seats, then California is going to negate that by making sure we gain 5 Democratic seats. It is interesting. There is some pushback there from average people and occasionally from some legislators.
Aubrey Jewett, always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Aubrey Jewett is a professor of political science at UCF. The 2026 Florida legislative regular session begins January 13th of next year. Coming up, a project on I-4 promises to improve traffic flow in Polk and Osceola counties. And later, we'll meet the man bottling up the flavors of Cuba and the Caribbean. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, Jose Juarez dreamed of bringing the flavors of his family to backyards everywhere. We'll meet the man called the Barbecuban, who is bringing the magic of Cuban mojo to shelves near you. But first, construction on Florida's Interstate 4 began in 1958. Back then, it was a state-of-the-art roadway connecting the two growing markets of Tampa and Orlando. Within a couple of years, it became the main conduit to the state's newest tourism draw, Disney World. Today, residents call it the Freeway of Death. They refer to exits as Malfunction Junction. They talk about haunted stretches called the I-4 Dead Zone. In other words, this highway has a lousy reputation as being unsafe, which is exactly why Florida Polytechnic University's Dr. Rawa Adla is placing sensors along the freeway. She's been leading a multi-year research project looking into traffic flow between Tampa and Orlando, studying driving habits and traffic patterns. The data she has been collecting will serve two purposes: creating a communications network between highway authorities and vehicles so they can all communicate with each other to facilitate smoother and safer travel. The other role will be to allow this communication network to evolve into a system for guiding autonomous vehicles. Dr. Adla joins Engage, and Dr., what makes this particular highway so treacherous for drivers?
the stretch between Tampa and Orlando is really dangerous. Not just the I-4 and the 75, overall between Tampa and Orlando, very dangerous because it connects to major metro areas, carries commuters, freight, tourist traffic, and also the roadway environment is very complex. It's one of the roadways that it has very closely spaced exits and frequent constructions. On top of this roadway, this road care, it's a main route to theme parks, beaches, ports, job centers. So the traffic is heavy almost all day everywhere. Due to all these types of driver, like we're talking about trucks, we're talking about tourists. So the mix of high volume and different driver types and sudden slowdowns makes this segment really much more crash prone.
Now, this is a two-phase project. The first phase involved modeling. The second phase involves placing sensors on I-4. What will these sensors be monitoring?
Based on our analysis and simulating, and when I say simulating, we're replicating the actual traffic data on I-4 in a simulation. So we're kind of, analyzing based on what's happening right now on the I-4. We're evaluating, does this technology will help reduce the number of crashes and make the travel easier without any delay? And actually, our analysis showed that the technology would really reduce the number of crashes at least to 25% and enhance the travel time by minimum of 50%.
And am I wrong for characterizing this technology as a precursor to the development of autonomous vehicles, vehicles that communicate both with each other and with a roadway authority sharing information about the roads? Are we seeing the development of autonomous vehicle technology here in Florida?
Actually, yes, it is part of it. So the project, as you said, it's phase one and phase two. For phase one, we did the analysis and we proved that with this technology, the traffic will be safer and smoother. So the Florida Department of Transportation now on the stage that they are implementing these communications, infrastructure communications, they are implementing the RSUs, which is the roadside units. And these roadside units, they will start communicating with vehicles on the road. Now, do we need autonomous vehicle right now? Definitely, we're looking for autonomous vehicle in the future. But for now, if you're driving your car, if your car has this onboard unit, or if it has any receiver, it's going to start receiving these communication, alarms, warnings. Otherwise, even like old vehicles, we evaluated like cell phone app, and this app will notify the driver about any actions needed.
I think the question that a lot of listeners are wondering, it might be, roughly when can we start seeing that autonomous technology acclimated into the consumer market? There's a lot of cities in the country where we're seeing the corporate applications in the form of Waymo or delivery vehicles. When are we going to see this in our dealership showrooms?
I can promise it's coming. However, all transportation agencies and car companies, they are not going to put the fully autonomous on the road unless we're sure that it's safer than the driver. We're moving very fast, especially here in Florida. So implementing these roadside units on the roads, it's going to improve the I-4 and it's going to reduce the number of crashes, as I said. And the study that we did showed that, do we need all vehicles to be equipped or to be autonomous to reduce the number of crashes or to enhance the travel time? What's really surprising is even with 50% of implementation, we can achieve the results.
Dr. Rawa Adla is an associate professor at Florida Polytechnic University. Dr. Adla, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Rick.
Interstate 4 runs just west of downtown Orlando, separating the historic Paramore community from the core of Orlando's urban corridor. The consequences of placing the freeway in a way that separated a thriving black neighborhood from the rest of the city can be seen today: declining property values and a lack of infrastructural investment. This was a trend throughout post-war America. The conscientious effort to use freeway development to separate communities and control property values and development. Robert Casanello is an associate professor of history at UCF. He joined Engage to discuss the impact the placement of I-4 has had on Orlando communities.
The municipal leaders in Orlando decided that I-4 should go through downtown Orlando. So that was done specifically in collaboration with local leaders, because typically when cities decided that interstates should go through downtowns, it was usually done under the belief that that would in some way kind of relieve traffic, if you will. And there wasn't really kind of thought given to what it might do to the built environment that the interstate will then occupy.
As you mentioned, this wasn't unique to Orlando. This was happening in cities across the country as suburbs grew, commutes developed, car ownership grew. This need to start connecting both the cities and the residential regions outside of the urban corridors. Talk about how the routing of these freeways was used to separate communities.
So interstates like I-4 would be sort of plotted to go either through a downtown or around a downtown. But what was key to build the interstate was to purchase the land the interstate would fall on. And typically when, you know, lawmakers and departments of transportation were looking to purchase the land that would become the interstate, typically they wanted to purchase land that was, let's say, we say at the cheapest value. And typically those were sort of inner city minority majority communities. You know, historic Black towns typically were where interstates were plotted in downtown. And we see this in Orlando with I-4, because I-4 bisects essentially Paramore, and Paramore is the historic Black downtown of Orlando. So basically where I-4 sits and later on other expressways sit is really what was the Black business district of downtown Orlando.
And I-4 begins to open up in 1956 into the 60s. What was both the short and the long-term impact on communities like Paramore, Pine Hills, Eatonville?
The planning of I-4 really kind of devastates Paramore because it divides Paramore in half and really kind of breaks the community up, destroys the historic Black downtown of Paramore. So Paramore is never again a whole community as it was before I-4. It's very different with Eatonville, because Eatonville is sandwiched between two affluent white suburbs, you know, that of Maitland and Winter Park. And folks in Winter Park did not want I-4 going through Winter Park, because originally the proposal was to, you know, have I-4 a bit closer to downtown Winter Park. And people in Winter Park protested this and came out to meetings to appeal to the developers of the interstate not to interfere with the historic downtown of Winter Park. So the fact that Eatonville is sandwiched between those two communities, it kind of was able to avoid some of the problems that Paramore had as far as I-4. But later on in the 1980s, there is an effort to expand Kennedy Boulevard, which runs through Eatonville. And the idea was to kind of create an off-ramp for I-4 at Kennedy Boulevard. There wasn't one, and there currently isn't one, because residents in Eatonville protested this, and they had a very successful campaign to stop that, I think in 1988. And so they were successful in keeping the growth of I-4 from interfering in their communities. Again, very different story from Paramore.
Going back to Paramore, what was the response from that specific community? Was there any political power? Was there any pushback? Was there any support or cogency of what this could do to that community?
When I-4 was being developed, what planners did is they had these meetings. And so they would have meetings and people would come out to the meetings. And so that I understand there was a meeting in Orlando, and later on there was a meeting in Winter Park. But this would have been the mid-1950s, and this would have been closer to the end of Jim Crow segregated Orlando. And during the I-4 time, there weren't planners of these meetings to give voice to where the interstate should go, didn't allow African-American residents to attend. So it was only white residents that attended these meetings that could voice their opinion about where I-4 should go. So African-Americans really didn't have a political opportunity to voice their concerns about where I-4 was going. It's a bit different in the early 1970s when the Department of Transportation builds the 408 Expressway, which sort of parallels I-4 and runs through Paramore again. But this time in the 1970s, it's after legal segregation. And African Americans are then able to attend those meetings and protest those things and voice their concerns, but they just didn't have a political opportunity to voice their concerns in the 1950s like they would in the 1970s at the further expansion of these expressways. You know, what the interstate represents, I think, in a lot of ways, is what the railroads represented back in the late 19th and early 20th century. You know, typically railroad lines would be a physical manifestation between black and white neighborhoods, right? And we see this in downtown Orlando, because there's a railroad track that runs through downtown Orlando that the SunRail now runs on. And on the east side of that railroad track was essentially the white downtown. And on the west side of that railroad track was the black downtown. And I think what we have with interstates, especially interstates in older historic downtowns like Orlando, is the interstates become kind of a new dividing line between black and white neighborhoods. And so what the interstate does is, of course, push out the black business class and push out the residential neighborhoods and homes that were along those interstates, but then creates this kind of barrier, this physical manifestation of residencies that would be negatively impact economically over time.
And fast forwarding, we get to the early 70s, Disney World opens. Did the development of that and later Universal, SeaWorld, the whole tourism corridor, help to cultivate these communities or contribute to their insularity? Was that a rising tide that rose all boats? You know, this was a freeway that does lead right to the happiest place on earth.
Yeah. So, I mean, with the development of the sort of the tourism corridor, if you will, to the west of downtown Orlando, I think that does really kind of impact the evolution and, you know, the development of not only the interstate, but the expressways here in Central Florida. It just kind of exacerbates what already was a problem with the interstate in the 1950s by decimating lower income housing in the downtowns. And so, you know, now if you're in Orlando, I mean, if you're on any interstate or expressway, if it is your interest, that will lead you to the parks some way, shape, or form. And I think, like, you know, that's the coming of Disney, the coming of Universal and SeaWorld and all this just sort of concentrated this idea that we needed more interstates, we needed more fast lanes, we needed more toll roads to kind of get people to and from that part of Central Florida to all different parts of Central Florida.
Robert Casanello is an associate professor of history at UCF. Next month, FDOT is beginning its Moving I-4 Forward Improvement Project along the Polk-Osceola County Corridor in an effort to improve safety and congestion. We'd like to hear from you about your concerns regarding this project's impact on your commute, or if you live along the corridor, your property values. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org. Just as Julie South of Winter Park did, Julie says, "Recently I've noticed I can hear loud I-4 traffic during high volume hours from my backyard. I live near Rollins College in Winter Park, not beside the I-4. I wish they'd do something to dampen the traffic sound. The sound of traffic is so intrusive that after living quietly in the same house for 60 years, I'm considering moving. But where to? I love it here." Thank you, Julie. Again, you can reach us at engage@cfpublic.org. Throughout the 70s and 80s, many despotic nations were well known for their use of secret police and internal surveillance used to keep their populations at bay. There was the KGB in the Soviet Union, and East Germany's Stasi were infamous for keeping the Eastern Bloc under the thumb of communism. South Africa's special branch enforced that nation's appalling apartheid policies into the 90s. And in Iran, Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi used a secret police agency called SAVAK to instill the terror necessary to sustain his corrupt rule. Despite the oppression that the Shah and SAVAK wrought on Iranians, the administration enjoyed broad support from the United States and its Western allies, as Pahlavi was staunchly anti-communist and committed to keeping Soviet-styled socialism out of his country. SAVAK was used to suppress political opposition of every kind. Their interrogation and torture tactics were so legendarily brutal that they taught their methods to secret police and intelligence agencies around the world, including to the CIA. By 1979, the Shah had overplayed his hand of brutality, and he was chased into exile and replaced with the Ayatollah Khomeini, who brought an extreme form of Islamic fundamentalist rule with him to Tehran. This is the revolution that brought about the Iranian hostage crisis that saw 52 employees of the American embassy in Iran being detained for 444 days. Following the Iranian Revolution, Khomeini simply changed the name of Savak, but it continues today, detaining and assassinating political opponents of the regime. And that brings us to Windermere, Florida, where Parviz Sabedi currently lives. He's lived in America since 1978. Today, Sabedi is facing a $225 million civil lawsuit brought by three unnamed California residents who accuse him of directing their torture at the hands of Savak. You see, Parviz Sabedi of Windermere, Florida, is alleged to have been the head of Iran's secret police and their chief torturer. Richard Luscombe is The Guardian's reporter in Florida. He broke this story back in September. Luscombe joined Engage to explain how Parviz Sabedi, the head of one of the world's most brutal secret police agencies, came to settle in an upscale enclave in Central Florida.
He was a very high-ranking official in the Iranian government before the Islamic Revolution in 1979. He was very well connected. He had military connections, and he rose to become one of the department heads of SAVAK, which is Iran's secret police and responsible for detaining and torturing political opponents of the Shah of Iran. He was quite a high riser in Iran. He'd sort of worked his way through the ranks to this level of seniority to where he was actually a personal friend of the Shah and very well trusted to execute the sort of happenings and the detentions and the sort of torture, the kind of stuff they were doing to these people. I mean, hundreds of people died. Thousands of people were badly treated. I mean, we detailed rapes, electric shocks, near drownings, forced extraction of finger or toenails, and this particularly barbaric piece of equipment that was called Apollo, which was an electric chair named after the early US space program, which featured a metal helmet that amplified victims' screams into their own ears. So it was pretty horrible stuff that was going on in these sort of cellars and Iranian jails in Tehran and elsewhere around the country at the time.
And in the late 70s, he fell out of favor with the Shah.
He did. I mean, there was a lot of sort of internal politics going on with the Shah's regime. It was looking more and more inevitable that things weren't going well and that the Islamic Revolution was about to sort of happen. So there was a lot of infighting in the Shah's administration at the time. Sabati was one of the first to leave Iran. He fled the country in late 1978, just a couple of months before the revolution happened, and made his way to the United States.
And he made his way to the United States with $20 million that he brought from Iran. I'm guessing, no way of knowing where that money came from.
There's not. And the allegation that he took it is sort of contained in various sort of papers and documents that were around. One was a leaked State Department document that was written at the time, but didn't emerge till many years later, detailing all the sort of surveillance and detail that the US government had on these characters that were part of the Iranian administration. And the source said that Sabati took about $20 million with him in 1978.
Carrying the resume that he did, how was he able to get into the United States and eventually obtain citizenship?
Well, I've approached the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, who didn't respond to my questions about that. But if you remember the Shah of Iran's administration, it was a very pro-Western government. And the fact that he came to the US would sort of indicate that they were sympathetic to him and he was allowed in. One thing I did establish during my research was that both Sabati and his wife are US citizens. So at some point, the US government gave them citizenship. This we know because they both voted in the US presidential election in November of last year, which obviously you can only do if you're a citizen. So it certainly seems as if the US government looked favorably upon Sabati, certainly when he arrived in 1978 and in the years since. He developed quite a successful life for himself in Florida under the name of Peter Sabati, which his lawyers insist is his middle name. But certainly he was known as Peter and set up some businesses. He was a successful property developer under that name of Peter. And so it was largely unknown to anyone in Florida who he was, what he was alleged to have been in Iran, and what he was alleged to have done during his time with the government there. I spoke to neighbors of his in the Windermere development in Florida where he lives, and they had no clue. They just knew him as Peter and his wife as Nancy, just a friendly retired couple. They'd wave to them out when they were out their morning walks, but didn't really know anything about them at all. They were a very quiet couple, by all accounts, who kept themselves to themselves and certainly didn't make any public pronouncements of who they are or who they were.
For 45 years, he's living under the radar with his wife in Central Florida as a developer. Nobody's connecting any dots that he used to be the director of the interrogation and torture program in Iran. So when does this all fall apart? How does his identity become apparent? How did these three Californians come to bring a civil suit against him?
Ironically, it was one of his own daughters who sort of outed him, if you want to use that phrase. There's quite a large, or sizable at least, Iranian diaspora in the United States that sort of hopes one day it's going to get back to running the government again. It sort of touts itself as a government outside the Iran, just sort of ready to move in and take over with the Shah of Iran's son as a lead character. And Sabati, we know, was engaged with this group. And then in February 2023, there was a demonstration in Los Angeles from this Iranian group. And Sabati's daughter posted a tweet of herself and some other people at this demonstration in Los Angeles denouncing Iran's Islamic government. And there in the picture is Parviz Sabati himself, who had not been seen for 45 years. And there he was. So people who had been looking for him or wondering where he'd gone saw this tweet and, hey, there he is. There's our guy. And then from there, the lawyers were able to sort of track him down into Florida and then launch this lawsuit last year.
And so these civil claims are being filed under the Torture Victims Protection Act and various Florida state codes. What has Sabati's and his attorney's response been to these charges?
I asked them for comment on the allegations against them, and I did not get a response from the lawyers. But they have filed several documents in court. It's a civil case, a $225 million civil lawsuit from these three men in California who claim that they were tortured by him, or certainly by Sadak at his direction years ago. So there's all kinds of allegations of what was done to them. Sabati's lawyers have filed all kinds of rebuttals to this in court, saying, no, he absolutely abhors torture. He would never have done this. You've got the wrong guy here, effectively saying that. So it's all got to play out in court. The case has been going on for a year. There was a very significant ruling just a month back when the judge threw out a lot of Sabati's claims. And now the judge has to decide whether the statute of limitations has run out or not under the Torture Victim Protection Act. Sabati's claiming that it's too late for these people, that these plaintiffs, to sue him. The judge isn't so sure. The judge is sort of weighing stuff up, and both sides have to submit their sort of arguments as to why the case should or should not continue. So it's all really down to the judge now. He could either dismiss the lawsuit and the whole thing goes away, or it moves forward to sort of pre-trial arguments then, and a possibility that a trial could take place next year. But that's far from certain at this point.
Is this gaining the attention of international courts, of The Hague?
It could do. I have not established to what extent this is being watched internationally. I think a lot will depend on what happens to this Florida case, which, as I said, could really sort of go either way. Remember, Sabati now, he's 89 years old. We don't know much about his health, but obviously this is many, many years after it was alleged to have happened. I mean, certainly you think back to the Second World War and that they were still going after Nazis years, if not decades later. So it's certainly not beyond the realms of possibility that this could attract sort of international justice. But at the moment, that hasn't happened.
And in the meantime, this is a civil trial, not a criminal trial. So Sabati's still living in Windermere in retirement?
That's correct. Yeah. Him and his wife own a mansion. We've looked at property records. They own a $3.6 million mansion in Windermere, which is a very upscale community in Central Florida. And the family, either through a family trust or the names of various family members, own several more properties around Central Florida as well. Some are sort of rental properties that are rented out, but they certainly have quite a sizable property empire in the Sabati's name.
So what's the next step? Where's this trial going from here?
Both sides have to submit their legal arguments now as to whether the case should or should not go forward. Like I said, there's some dispute between the sides on whether the statute of limitations has expired on the Torture Act. So it's really now in the lawyers and the court's hands to decide how it will proceed.
Richard Luscombe reports for The Guardian from Florida. The case against Parviz Sebedi is currently pending before the Orlando Division of the United States District Court's Middle District of Florida.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
HBCU pride will once again be on display in Orlando this weekend, this time on the courts instead of the gridiron. The inaugural HBCU Hoops Invitational tips off today at the ESPN Wide World of Sports Complex, with men's and women's teams representing HBCUs throughout the East, including Florida schools Bethune-Cookman University, FAMU, Florida Memorial University, and Edward Waters University. The non-conference games will play at the State Farm Fieldhouse. Haywood Workman founded the Invitational with his wife, Kelly. Workman is a veteran NBA star and later spent 3 years as a referee in the league. He spoke with Engage last night about what inspired him to create this tournament.
Well, it came about because I attended Winston-Salem State. As a 19-year-old kid, I was on a football scholarship, but I was also the starting point guard. And the culture, the heritage, it really stayed with me through my years. And so I wanted to do something to give back. And when I was transitioning from playing to becoming a ref, I didn't see any HBCUs at the Maui Invitational. And I live in Florida, so me came out, and what better place to have a basketball tournament than Disney?
The three-day event transcends basketball. Symposiums addressing financial, mental, and physical health are scheduled, as well as networking opportunities for students. Workman explained why it's important for athletes to work on their lives off the court.
Basketball is basketball, but there's more to life than basketball. So one of the things that I have had to go through learning on the fly was how to handle finances, how to handle my mental health, how to apply for a job, just certain things. And so I wanted to incorporate that with the tournament, because these athletes, some may get it, some may not, but some may not even have the opportunities to talk to professionals that can help them and have conversations and build relationships with to help them, you know, get over the hurdle of graduating from an HBCU that is underserved or an under-resourced.
With the Florida Classic and the HBCU Hoops Invitational just weeks apart, I asked Workman if he sees the opportunity for Central Florida to develop as a nexus for HBCU athletics and culture.
We've aligned ourselves as the HBCU Florida basketball exclusive event. And so I think cultivating basketball more, because football dominates the Southeast, but basketball is here to stay. And we just have to present that in a way for people to want to come and experience this.
The inaugural HBCU Hoops Classic starts today. Events run through Sunday. We'll have links for more information on our website, cfpublic.org. Coming up, we'll meet an area man who put his passion for Cuban flavors in a bottle. Engage travels to Ocala to meet Jose Juarez, the Barbacuban. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. As a native of the Philadelphia area, I can assure you all stereotypes you've heard about the cuisine of the city of brotherly love are true. Our bones are built from steak sandwiches, our muscles from hoagies. Tasty cakes fill out much of the rest, and we have Cheese Whiz and Frank's Black Cherry in our veins. I thought I'd been to the mountain of sandwiches. Hell, I reached the peak. Eating cheesesteaks at places with names like Jim's, Gino's, Pat's, and Delisandro's. Last year, I moved here, and I found a new peak to summit. I've had Cuban sandwiches before in Phoenix, in Philly, in Las Vegas. I've never had anything like I've enjoyed here in Florida. Sometimes there's only one place to find the real thing. And that is why I was happy to drive to Ocala to meet Jose Juarez.
So you have the first layer is Swiss cheese. And then we have ribeye that's been ground and smoked. And then on top of that, we have sweet sliced ham. And then you have garlic pickles. And then you have a mojo double smoked pulled pork. And then another layer of Swiss cheese and 455 sauce.
The sandwich is exquisite, but I'm not here just for the marinated pork and paper-thin ham. I'm here for that 455 sauce that Juarez mentioned. You see, during the day, Jose Juarez is in branding and marketing, that sort of nebulous space between advertising and public relations. He worked primarily with car companies and auto racing. His office is cluttered with NASCAR memorabilia. He drives an immaculate 71 Pontiac GTO. Convertible, of course. But for Jose Juarez, that's work. His real passion began to emerge after he left the office.
I'd usually get home around 7 o'clock at night, and I'd start grilling, barbecuing, creating different sauces for myself, flavors, and it was just, to me, that is the fun part of the barbecue sauce we've had. I've probably created it 15, 20 years ago, and just for my own self, and then my daughter got married, everybody got a bottle of it, but I never officially bottled it. It's just been fun.
Juarez took barbecue sauce really seriously. He wanted to create something that reflected his Cuban roots. His family moved to Oregon when he was little, and as a youth, Juarez found connecting with his culture to be challenging.
There really wasn't a Cuban community, you know. When we moved there, I always tell everybody we're bad navigators because everybody else made it to Florida and we just kept going until we hit Portland. But, back then, immigration's a little different. You had to have a sponsor and, you know, we had a sponsor. We had, you know, the Catholic Church. My father found a job. My dad actually went to school in the United States. So in the 50s, he went to Fork Union Military Academy. So he knew English already. So we had that going for us, you know. So when we went into Oregon, it wasn't like there was any kind of a community. You just blended in and you know, you became an American, you know. I mean, it's like, so we always spoke Spanish at home and English outside of the house.
And his home was the one place in Portland Juarez could count on finding his Cuban connections. And like so many do, he found his soul in the kitchen.
We never really went out to eat. You know, every night we'd have a meal, you know, and it was always, you know, whether it was ropa vieja, you know, those are all peasant foods, but they're delicious, you know, black beans and rice. My mom makes the best black bean. I have that recipe and I'll make it for special occasions. And, you know, we'll do the roast pork, lechon asado. We would cook whole hogs on Christmas. So yes, it was 100% yuca. And our barbecue sauce was mojo. We never used a brown barbecue sauce. It was always the mojo marinade that would go on the steaks, it'd go on this, and 4th of July, it would be burgers, you know, and hot dogs. So that was like the American twist.
Juarez took those memories and mixed them with a passion to make the perfect sauce. He calls the result 455 sauce, a condiment combining the seasonings and spices of the Caribbean with the tangy yellow mustard that is ubiquitous with the Cuban sandwich, and a touch of sweet reminiscent of the brown sugar and molasses found in traditional American barbecue sauces. The 455 refers to the size of the engine piston Juarez uses to press his sandwiches. He kept working on his sauce until one day his wife starts telling him about a morning show on network TV, Live with Kelly and Michael.
She says, they're looking for America's next grill star, and you ought to enter the show. So long story short, I entered it, and you had to come up with a theme and a name. And we all got together, and the name became Barbecue. And actually, a friend of ours came up with that name. We're like, it's a cool name. So you're the Barbecue. And yep, what are you going to create? Well, what I'm going to create is a combo of a burger and a Cuban sandwich. It's the best of both worlds. Born in Cuba, raised in Portland, Oregon, actually. And then that's what got me to enter this contest. Became a semifinalist, and then ended up winning the whole thing. 10 people in the U.S., I become America's next grill star.
The next obvious step was to bottle this up and get it to retail shelves. He got Publix to pick up his sauces. Then Governor Rick Scott asked him to bring his barbecue to the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. This year, He got an invite to the big time when he fielded a phone call from a local Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Walmart just contacted us. They have a Made in America campaign, and Orlando is one of the stops. Would you like to apply? I said, sure. And so I applied. We got accepted, had a face-to-face meeting in Orlando. We started going through the process, at which point I presented all my sauces. They picked three. And they said, we're going to advance these three September 2nd. That was like on a March. We'll let you know whether you're in or out for the next step. September 2nd, we get congratulations. You've been chosen to go to Bentonville and present your product.
Jose Juarez and his wife Kelly drove to Arkansas and presented their sauce to Walmart, the nation's biggest brick-and-mortar retail. And his sauces were chosen over more than 6,000 other products. Jose Juarez won the golden ticket.
You get the deal, and then there's they make a big deal out of it. There's, you know, they parade you around, you hold the golden ticket, pictures, press.
There's a physical ticket.
Oh, there's a physical ticket. Yeah, there's a big
ticket. It's like Willy Wonka.
It is exactly, you got the golden ticket, you're going around the whole place and everybody's cheering, and then they have media in there and they put you, and then you take a picture with a gigantic golden ticket, you know, and so they make a really big deal, you know, about this. So yeah, then you go home and go, we got to get to work.
Juarez's 455 sauce will be on Walmart shelves next year at about 100 stores throughout Florida. For the Barbecuban, this is only a start. But at the end of the day, Jose Juarez is just as happy as where he started, in the kitchen, stirring a simmering pot of mojo.
There's no real magic ingredient, honestly. It's doing it the right way, the artisan way, the old-fashioned way, the same way as you would do it at home.
That's all for today's edition of Engage, and we want to hear from you. Let us know what you'd like to hear more about or what you're glad you heard. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.